Good morning, everyone. How you doing? Professor Lemanic here. Hey, I hate to do these pre-recorded videos, but unfortunately, where we got that whole whopping, like, inch of snow and the college decided to cancel our class, this is something we're going to have to deal with. One of the beauties of the modern era in which we live in, we have the technological capability, you know, to keep our learning going forward, and with the college canceling school, you know, we got a lot of stuff we got to get through, so unfortunately, you know, I got to do this. Now, with luck, this will be the only time I have to do this, but going forward, if for some whatever reason the college cancels class, we're supposed to give alternative assignments, and rather than me, you know, having you read the whole chapter and, you know, consider it learning, I figured I would just give you this video presentation. Hopefully you all watch it all the way through, because in my mind, this information will be on the exam. I'm going to hold you accountable to it. And simultaneously, I'm going to pick up wherever I left off on Thursday. No, sorry, Wednesday. We're Monday, Wednesday. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm half asleep, so it is what it is. Hopefully, I won't be a bumbling buffoon. All right, so we had a good discussion. I really, really enjoyed our class on Wednesday, so thank you all. Again, I really appreciate the interactiveness and the thoughtfulness of the conversations that we've had. So it's very important. You know, this isn't just me, you know, imposing my thoughts on you. You know, it's if you have an opinion, you know, I definitely welcome it. All right, so we were talking about just some of the big broad comments, you know, what is a government and what's it supposed to do and all the rest. And obviously, we did make our list when we were talking about what government was, and I think we were all pretty much on the same page, which is a nice thing. But now we're going to go forward and we need to add some specificity to our understanding of things. And this rhetorical question right here is something, you know, that we hear a lot of, particularly in the last presidential campaign. You know, what type of government do we have? Well, one of the weird things, and this is a manifestation of recent history. I'm trying to think back when I was your age. Yeah, when I mean, it started popping up, but it really was not used as much as it is today. In our society today, politicians like using the word democracy. And again, it's very interesting. You know, the whole Biden's propaganda in the campaign going against Trump was, you know, that, you know, we're trying to preserve democracy. And of course, I find that ironic when you look at the actions of both parties, but the Democrats in particular. This last election, the powers that be, the elites of the Democrat Party, decided to dump the candidate that the Democrat voters elected in the primaries. You know, they dumped Joe Biden. They forced him out of the race. And then they chose Kamala Harris, who didn't receive a single vote. If you look back when she was attempting to run for the presidency in 2020, she dropped out of the primary races before the first election even occurred. So she didn't get a single vote. And this time around, they put Kamala in just a couple of weeks before the Democrat National Convention. Again, she didn't get a single vote. So again, whenever the Democrats talk about democracy, it's a misnomer. It's not factually based, because democracy is a system where the people decide. Well, as for our system of government, we don't have a democracy. And I said this in class, and I'm going to stick to it. Because the truth is, we are not a democracy by any means. The term is nowhere in the Declaration of Independence. The term is nowhere in our Constitution. For a reason. And the reason is simple. Words mean things. You can't take a word that has a definition and impose a new meaning on it. Because what you end up doing is you basically destroy the meaning of the word. So when you look at the word democracy, it has a clear meaning. And it is a very, very old word that comes from the birthplace of where this system of government, democracy, was born. And that's the ancient Greek world. It comes from two words that were stitched together. Demos is the Greek word for the people. And kratos, it's the authority of power. So the true meaning of democracy, essentially, just to make it simple, is that the people rule. The people are in charge. The problem is democracy, in the eyes of the founding fathers, is mob rule. Because what it is, it's majoritarianism. Because decisions are based upon the will of the majority of the people. This is the direct democracy that was in place in some of the Greek city-states. Not all city-states were democracies, but Athens was the most famous. In those systems, the people would gather together and they would vote either by hands or by putting in painted rocks into buckets. And whatever the majority decided, that was the law. There was nothing for other opinions. It was essentially, again, mob rule. Now, the irony is that in Athens, only about 10% of the population were actually considered the people. To be a citizen in Athens, you had to be able to prove that both your mother and your father were citizens of Athens, that they were born there. So there was no immigration allowed. If you were an immigrant, or if your mother married, your mother was from one city but moved in and married an Athenian, you would not be a citizen. You would not be allowed to vote. Only pure-blooded Athenians could vote. Pure-blooded males, I should say, could vote. So even the Athenian democracy was a system where only like 10% of the population had full power to make the decisions. It was an elitist system. And often, wherever these democracies were in place, you ended up with dictators. Because the majority would basically give all power to one person to impose their will upon the rest of the population. Now, when you fast forward into around the time of our country's formation, when democracy came into English usage, it was always viewed negatively. The founding fathers, they always attached the word democracy to undesirable things. Mobs, lack of standards, and basically a system where leaders will basically manipulate the emotions and prejudices of the rabble. As James Madison wrote in Federalist Number 10, excuse me, democracies have ever been found incompatible with the personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they've been violent in their deaths. Basically, the founding fathers realized if you have people voting and having full control, they're only going to vote for their own interests. And in the end, what they start doing is what ended up happening in Athens. The majority starts voting to take things from the minority and essentially crush the minority, not racial minority, but I mean is the people who are against whatever the decision is. So, you know, we're going to raise taxes. Well, who are we going to raise taxes on? Well, we're going to raise taxes on whoever doesn't vote to raise taxes. Or we're gonna go to war. Oh, you're a pacifist, you don't want to go to war? Fine, we're going to vote and we're going to take your land and we're going to use that to pay for the soldiers. Heck, the Athenian democracy voted to have one of the greatest thinkers who ever walked the earth, Socrates. They convicted him, based on majoritarianism, of corrupting the youth because he was trying to get kids to think. So democracies are dangerous, and Madison points that out. And by the way, John Adams essentially said the same thing. In a letter to John Taylor, one of the other founding fathers that he was friends with, in 1814, John Adams said, and I quote, "Democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There has never been a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. It is in vain to say that democracy is less vain, less proud, less selfish, less ambitious, or less avaricious than aristocracy or monarchy. It is not true, in fact, and nowhere it appears in history. Those passions are the same in all men under all forms of simple government, and when unchecked, produce the same effects of fraud, violence, and cruelty." They knew if you allow everybody to control every decision, you will essentially destroy the country. Because let's face facts. Democracy implies that everyone has a say. What happens if you do not understand? You don't take the time to learn the impact of the decisions that you're going to make? Well, you could vote against something that you thought you were in favor of, but you could be manipulated based on the way it was presented into voting against the exact opposite. And by the way, that happens all the time. So, the truth is, not only we are not a democracy, but because of the sheer size of our country, and not just in terms of population, but in geography, we could not have a democratic system, a true democratic system. It just would not work. Because ultimately, you would have a system that the founding fathers was terrified of. You know, that's one of the reasons, for example, we have a direct democracy. We don't have a direct democracy. Why we have the Electoral College. Why we don't vote for the president. Because the founding fathers recognized if we had a directly elected president, as opposed to the Electoral College based on popular vote, the populations of the cities would basically determine every single president. And those presidents would only do what's good for the people in the cities. And they would screw the farmers over and the rest of the country. So what do we have? Well, the thing you need to remember is that our founding generation, the founding fathers, were the best of the best. They were educated. They were knowledgeable. They were lawyers. They all had college degrees. They all had experience in running government. So what they did before they made any decision is they took time to engage in research. They looked through history to try to find a system that essentially gave the people a say, but at the same time existed to protect everybody. Because that's one thing democracy does not do. Democracy only protects the winners, the people that are voting for the measures, the majority. And the rights of the minority are ignored. So knowing that, the founding fathers looked to the Greeks, in particular, Plato. And they focused on what Plato referred to as the politeia. The politeia literally means the rights of the citizens within the state. The politeia, the rights of the citizens. So if the focus of society is on the rights of the citizens, then you have to have a system of government that essentially not only serves the rights of the citizens, but focuses on protecting the rights of the citizens. Again, keep in mind the Declaration of Independence, the quote that I read last class. where Jefferson literally states that the purpose of government is to secure our unalienable rights. That's the view of the Founding Fathers. That is Plato's Politeia. So how does it work? Well, according to Plato, the only way to protect the rights of the people is to basically put in charge philosophers, philosophic rulers who are well-educated, well-knowledgeable on the realities of the world, and basically have them serve as guardhouses in power to protect the rights of the people. Because by giving them this ability, they essentially will serve the society as a whole. Because they won't be able to differentiate between different classes of people. And again, I get it. I know the realities. I know we're talking really high-level idealism. But that was the vision that Plato was talking about. That we would basically get the best and the brightest, who would serve with honor and distinction, and in those roles would look to basically protect everybody. That they were unassailable, that they were uncorruptible, that they would be pure. As Plato said, unless philosophers become kings in their countries, or those who are now called kings and rulers come to be sufficiently inspired with a genuine desire for wisdom, there can be no rest from troubles. There is no other way of happiness, either for the state or the individual. We're not talking about politicians that get into politics because they can't get any other job. And that they're there to basically rake in campaign money and basically live in multiple homes and manipulate the people. No, we're talking about people who are willing to give everything to basically ensure justice for all. Now, FYI, what the Founding Fathers ended up doing was adopting the Latin version of Plato's Politeia. Res publica, the republic. The res publica was the system that existed in Rome from the overthrow of the Etruscan kings in, I think it was like 510 or 519 BC, all the way up to the emergence of Julius Caesar. And by the way, this is what our system was created, the Republic. Our Republic allows the government to retain authority to make decisions. And it can retain authority either directly or indirectly. But here's the interesting thing. How do the leaders get authority? Well, simple. They get it by winning elections. So again, this is in the realm of Plato's Republic. Essentially, we the people choose who we're going to put in, and we trust them to do good by all of us. But here's the interesting thing. By having elections, it essentially eliminates mob rule. Because everybody has the ability to have a say. So there's the participation of the people. But the Constitution and the system itself cures democracy of its weaknesses. Because the majority cannot vote and strip the rights of the people. No, the Constitution's put in place and essentially it locks the rights of the people, guarantees them, shields them from mob rule. Essentially, as James Madison in particular wrote about, he said that this system is a check on the mob. From Federalist Number 10. It will be more difficult for unworthy candidates to practice with success the vicious arts by which elections are too often carried, and the suffrages of the people, being more free, will be more likely to center in men who possess the most attractive merit and the most diffusive and established characters. In the minds of the founding fathers, why would we elect somebody who is going to strip us of our rights? Federalist Number 10 again. So what do we have today? Well, the problem is, and this goes back to the presidential election of Andrew Jackson. Today, democracy and republic are used interchangeably, even though we are in fact and by law a republic. Because our republic exists. It's a federal republic that is representative, and it's formed of an indivisible union of 50 sovereign states. That, of course, is made up of a national, a state, and local governments. Do I expect you to remember all that? No, but that is the full totality of our system. If we're going to be precise, it is a federal republic. It's federal because we have power shared amongst levels of government. It's representative. People in power are not nobles. They're not born into it. We put them and they're supposed to represent their constituents, us, the people. And of course, we are a union that is comprised of 50 sovereign states, and those also have their own power. And of course, every single state is made up of counties and local governments, where power, again, it's all divided up into different tiers, and each tier has responsibilities based on what we want. Now, FYI, Massachusetts is also a republic. But when our Constitution was framed, John Adams used the old English version of republic, Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is a noun that dates back to the 15th century in England, and it basically defines how our system is supposed to run. Common refers to general, meaning applies to everybody, and wealth is reference to well-being. So essentially, a commonwealth is a state in which the supreme power is vested in the people, and the purpose of government is essentially to preserve that well-being of us, all of us, in common. But again, if you want to move from English and you go to Latin, there's the res publica. They're interchangeable terms. Now, as I mentioned, our system operates based on a set of rules. And these rules are contained within the Constitution. To use a political science term, it is constitutionalism. Essentially, the entire system, the checks and balances, the separation of power, federalism, due process, the Bill of Rights, all of that stuff has been written down in a governing document that basically serves as the buffer between the government and the people. Our Constitution basically defines the powers of government, and it forces our leaders to consider the general will. But at the same time, our system, our Constitution, also gives us the means to hold our leaders politically and legally accountable for how they exercise their powers. So, if, for example, We have an elected member of the Senate that is in power, is making money, and is making, trying to pass laws that hurts us. We, the people, have the ability to get them out. We can unelect them. You know, we don't have to form a mob and go to their house and drag them out onto their streets and tar and feather them. No, we don't have to engage in violence. All we need to do is when the election time comes around, we basically say, you're done, you're fired, and we put somebody new in place. Now, by the way, our Constitution literally guarantees our republic. In Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, it states that the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion, and on the application of the legislature or the executive, against domestic violence. So it literally is the job of the U.S. government to make sure we have a republican form of government. All right then, let's bring it back full circle. Then why do they say democracy? Well, you have a political party called the Democrat Party. And as I said to before, the word democracy entered into our political lexicon when Andrew Jackson, in the presidential election of 1828, after losing the presidential election of 1824, broke his party away from the Jefferson Republican Party and created what he called the Democrat Party. So the Democrats have been using the word democracy to make the people think subconsciously of their political party. It's basically propaganda. And as I said, when I was a kid, it wasn't as prevalent. When you went to school, you learned about the fact that we were a republic, or sometimes they would use that we are a democratic republic. But democracy has come to superimpose itself in the last couple of decades because of actions of one of our political parties. And by the way, in case you were not aware, I can almost guarantee probably just about every single history or political science teacher you had were probably also Democrats. If all you heard was democracy. Because they're trying to win elections. All right. So, what should our government be doing? What are the basic tasks of government? Well, to give you a good legal lawyer type answer, well, it depends. It depends upon what jurisdiction we're talking about. On a national level, the job of the national government is to ensure our survival. The government exists, the national government, to defend us, we the people, from foreign external threats, while at the same time preventing civil chaos, disorder, in war. So yes, and I don't mean to be political, but in light of what we got going on, the job of the U.S. government is to shut our borders when we are being invaded. The job of the U.S. government is to deport those people who have broken into our country illegally. Now, the why they are here or where are they coming from does not matter. Remember, we are a nation of laws, and if our laws create a system of legal immigration, that is the process that's supposed to be followed. And if someone chooses to make their first decision is to break into our country, cross the border illegally, then they are criminals. They have violated the law. So it's the job of our government to basically protect us, the law-abiding, from those who commit criminal actions. It's also to prevent the states from going at one another. And if need be, to go to war and fight other countries in our name. Because the national government is supposed to maintain our well-being. On a state level, well, state government also has a very important role. The state government is in charge of policing matters and also providing services for the residents, such as providing schools, providing public spaces, parks, walking trails, also supposed to provide the infrastructure, the roads, the sewerage, made sure that, you know, there are electricity poles so that when we turn on our lights, you know, the lights come on. Those are supposed to be state or local issues. The national government should not be involved in those issues. The national government has its own job. But the state and local, well, they do what we're supposed to do. All right. Now, of course, the government can't do it all. And often what you see is that the government's ability to engage in some type of action, even if it's desired by the people, is limited by capacity. You know, how quickly can governments effectively respond in times of crisis? Can they manage conflict? Can they make decisions that are responsible? So, for instance, let's say you live in a small town and your school is crumbling. Well, the people who are going to pay most of the money for the school are the people who live in the town. The homeowners, the taxpayers. They have a right to vote on whether or not they're going to build a new school. And what happens if the majority of the people can't afford it? Well, a new school may sound nice, but if the people can't afford it, that means the town lacks the capacity to basically build a new school. And again, capacity goes to all governmental actions. You know, there are, as we saw in California, there are only so many firefighters. And there is only so much water. Although when the government is making decisions to not have water in the hydrants, you know, that's a stupid decision. But again, no water, you can't put the fire out. That's a good example of capacity. So ultimately, our government cannot protect us from cradle to grave. There is only so much the government, any level of government, can do. That means the rest of your life, you are responsible for. It's not the job of the government to make sure that you have a house. It's not the job of the government to make sure you have a job. It's not the job of the government to make sure you have food on the table. That's your responsibility. Because as I said, by the way, we were talking about healthcare. Remember, in our country, and it's statistically true, about 50% of our population are the one who's working. And 50% of the people don't. And many of them can, but they're too lazy. And so what does our government do, particularly the Democrats, to make sure they can win elections? They give people free stuff that is paid for by others. That's just not right. All right, I've already defined capacity, so let's go forward. So how does the government do what it does? Well, basically, it depends on what level of government we're talking about. The federal government can increase capacity by making new programs, creating new agencies, and they can do it pretty much at a snap of a finger because the government, the federal government, is not bound by limitations on spending. There was an attempt back when Bill Clinton was president, when he was working with Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, when, believe it or not, the Democrats and the Republicans were working together for the common good. They weren't doing, oh, Democrats good, Republicans bad, and vice versa, like the BS we're dealing with now. But there was an attempt to pass a balanced budget amendment that would have actually required the government only to spend the money that it took in. Well, unfortunately, that amendment failed. Let's just put it this way. I think when George W. Bush became president, I think the federal deficit was $2 trillion. Let me see, U.S. debt clock. And today, after having George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Trump 1, Biden, and then Trump 2. Let me see. I don't have my glasses on. Our current national debt is $36 trillion. Now, here's the interesting thing. Our government is spending, in this last fiscal year, $7 trillion. But the problem is that the government has only taken in $2 trillion. Nope, sorry. Hold on. Correction. I'm reading the wrong thing. So the U.S. government this fiscal year has spent $7 trillion, but they've only collected $5 trillion in revenue. So this year, the debt clock is going to increase by $2 trillion. And again, I kid you not, when George W. Bush was president, it was only $2 trillion. Now it's almost $37 trillion. It's insane. And why is that? Well, think of how much money the Biden administration spent on things like the Green New Deal. And they gave out trillions of dollars in COVID relief. And the same was true when Donald Trump was in president, right? Because he was there when COVID started. It was the Trump administration that first engaged in those COVID handouts. And then when Barack Obama was in he made Obamacare, and he had the federal government start spending money on people's health care programs. And then George W. Bush, when he was there, we had the war on terror. All of these things cost more money than the government takes in. So what does our government do? They don't limit themselves to have a balanced budget. They just spend. Well, the problem is at the state and local level, most states and most local governments legally cannot deficit spend, meaning they only can spend what they take in. Massachusetts, all cities and towns must every single year put forward a balanced budget, meaning they have to write out every dollar they're spending, and they have to show every dollar that they take in, and it must be balanced. You can never have a situation in a town where they spend more than they collect. Now, by the way, in Massachusetts, it's the same thing. The state government was supposed to have a balanced budget, but in the 1800s, they passed a measure that basically allows the state government to borrow. So we have a reserve fund, and they use that. Do I really want to get complicated? No, I don't want to get that technical, because I'll just confuse the heck out of you. Let's just say the state has the ability to borrow money. So technically it's not spending what it doesn't have, but what it does is it supplements the tax dollars and adds to it the loans. So next year, you know, we're going to have to pay more because we have to pay on the interest for the money that we borrowed. There are some states, though, that don't have that limitation. California. California has more debt than I think any other state. And I think it's most of the states combined, if I remember the stat correctly. Not quite as bad as the U.S. government, but it's hundreds of billions of dollars, so it's just insane. So, how then does the government decide what it's going to spend its money on? How does the government decide what it's going to do, what type of programs it's going to pursue? Well, we have to be realists. The government shifts through its decisions by essentially engaging in politics. the dirty word that many people just despise. Politics. Now, here's the funny thing, and I want you to remember this, because it's the truth. Politics is nothing more than people's opinions. But when the government engages in politics, it's nothing more than the politicians' opinions on how to spend your money. That's something my grandfather used to say. Basically, politics is the process of fulfilling the duties and responsibilities within society. Politics involves the people, the constituents, basically making, I don't want to say demands, because that's a harsh word in its true meaning. So we'll say, it's requests is too, whatever. They're making demands. They want the government to do certain things. And the politicians basically have to spend time engaging in tactics to figure out how to implement the policy demands of the people, to essentially do what the people want. Now, of course, truth be told, more often than not, particularly at the national level, the politicians, they don't care what the people want. They're going to do what's good for them and their specific voters. Meaning, the Republicans are only going to do what they think the Republican voter wants them to do. And a Democrat politician is only going to do what the Democrat voter wants them to do. Of course, the problem is every now and then you get candidates like Donald Trump. Now, this may shock you, but if you actually take the time to ignore everything that you see on social media and everything that you've read and see on the news, Donald Trump is actually a Democrat. He was a Democrat his whole life. And he only decided to become a Republican when he got mad at Barack Obama, who happened to be a Democrat. But if you look at Donald Trump's Make America Great Again, the policies that he are pursuing are the same policies that Democrats like JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Truman, even FDR to a degree. Those old school Democrats used to be conservatives, fiscal conservatives that were nationalists. So Donald Trump pushing Make America Great Again is he's not going to the extreme right or the extreme left. He's actually trying to take the nation to the center to do what's good for we the people. And the problem that Donald Trump has is he's not a good at articulating. He has a wicked warped sense of humor, and he likes pushing buttons. And that's, to many people, what turns them off. But again, if you spend time just realizing that at times Donald Trump doesn't even take himself seriously, and just kind of see the forest for the trees, you'll kind of see, yeah, he's not a traditional Republican. Traditionally, Republicans were, only pro-business. He didn't care about, they didn't care about lowering expenses on the common people. And traditionally, the Democrats, kind of were the party of the blue-collar workers. But they lost that when the Democrats went really, really left-wing, focusing on identity politics. So the typical Trump voter is not a traditional Republican. More often than not, they're kind of centrists. Many of them, again, union workers, truck drivers, farmers, those blue-collar guys that used to vote Democrats. And what policies he's trying to pursue? Well, again, focusing on us. But of course, the opposition. All of the people, blah, 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 on TV. It's hard. So that's the reason why when we were talking about when he put the pause, just stop. Don't freak out about anything and sit back and watch how things play out, because that's how politics function. You don't get instant gratification. Politics takes time because you got to work out how to deliver the policy. Now, politics, of course, changes. Politics change over time. Politics also change in different locations. Politics also varies from different circumstances. But ultimately, politics are the beliefs, the values, the attitudes that not only shape society, but often define the political behavior of the people and the political institutions that are in place and the political outcomes. Essentially, politics and culture are one. So, for example, in our society, one of the big core elements of our political culture is that we expect individual rights and we expect the government to basically leave us alone. Well, that's not true everywhere in the world. There are some societies where the expectation is that the government actually tells you where to go, what to do, what job you can have, where to live. And that's perfectly acceptable. But in our country, it's different. So you have differences on a global level, but you also have differences over time. Politics are never stagnant. They're always fluid. That's a good way to think about it. They're always changing. The other thing that politics are linked to is the dominant religion of a society. Because if most of the people adhere to a core sense of ethics and morality, well, those values ultimately are going to shape what is just. So, what do we mean? Well, essentially, culture and a government or the institutions, they don't exist in a vacuum. You know, each exerts an influence over the other. So, if we were to have a king, you know, there would be people who would push to keep the king because they liked having one person in charge to tell us what to do. Again, think about how long, how many periods in time, how many societies had nobility, where the vast majority of people sat back and said, well, that person is born a smith, so because of the family that he was born into, he has more rights and privileges than I do. And they would be people who would go to war to defend that system. Well, of course, in our society, it's different. We focus on social equality. And we expect that sense of social equality to apply to everybody. To a degree, ironically, it kind of acts as an unwritten constitution. So, even though we may differ on some of our politics, overall, there is a core area, a foundation, on which all people in our country kind of agree. And that is essentially the values that make up this unwritten constitution. Now, it's not easy to achieve. And by the way, it's not the same. It's not equal to political behavior. So just because we have this element that's in place, that doesn't mean everybody acts the same. Okay? So politics, culture related, it's how we move forward. We also know it changes over time. Religion, the values of society play a huge role. This is the unwritten rules by which we all abide by. But again, this unwritten constitution doesn't mean that we're all going to act the same. Just kind of bring all this together. Now, at our core, our society, our political culture, is rooted in the Judeo-Christian traditions. this is what makes all Western civilizations, those nations that arose in Western Europe, and we are descendant of Western civilization, this is what makes us unique. We are different than the Middle East, Africa, Asia, South America. Because our society is founded upon these core principles. And I'm not saying that we are all religious, but the values that come out of those religions, and by the way, as I think I might have said, religion is nothing more than philosophy. We're not talking about the institution churches. You know, the churches are the institutions, but the philosophy of the religion, those are where the values come from. And our values, our sense of right and wrong, whether you go to church or not, are based upon Judeo-Christian traditions. For example, only in the Judeo-Christian tradition are individuals legally, spiritually, emotionally considered as being important. We are not viewed as part of a mass. We are viewed as us. Simultaneously, we are also individually expected to be held responsible for the consequences of our actions. In other words, if I do something to you, I'm going to get punished. My wife, my kids, my father, they're not going to get punished. I'm going to be the one held responsible. We're also expected to contribute to society. And not just monetarily. But again, we're supposed to, you know, community service. You know, we're supposed to pay it forward. You know, there's many, many terms from it. But basically, we're supposed to engage ourselves in our communities in a spiritual or a helpful or an honest way. We also believe that the law, we are a nation of laws, to a degree that the law is divine. But if you look at the words of the founding fathers, wisdom, our constitution, the ability to make these laws are gifts from God, a higher power. So the beauty of having our rights given from a higher power means no one can take them from us. Remember, Declaration of Independence, unalienable rights. God-given rights that no man, no institution can interfere with. We also believed that those in power should be held to the same standards, if not higher standards, than us. You know, we expect them to be honest, to be sincere. We expect them to work on our behalf. We don't expect anarchy. We don't expect chaos. We don't expect corrupt authorities, although we know there's corruption there. But that's on us. That's our fault for keep re-electing these corrupt scumbags. We also, overall, just like the Jewish and the Christian traditions, we don't believe that violence is desirable. We don't want war. But most of us accept that maybe violence is needed at times to protect the common good. And one other aspect of it, hope. Hope. And this comes from the Judeo-Christian, all have enshrined in us is a sense of hope that we will have a successful life, that we will be able to do good by ourselves and our loved ones, and basically be free and happy. The pursuit of happiness. Those are all values that come out of these philosophies. Ah, way to go, Lemanic. Instead of me just babbling, I could have just clicked. Awesome. Well, here's the other thing. What happens when politics differ? Well, when politics differ, politics, because it's emotionally driven opinion, can at times, and has, even in our country, resulted in violence and bloodshed. So, let's look. Here's the pointer. Oh, there's the Summer of Love. There's the mostly peaceful protests that took place in Minneapolis. Gotta love that. Of course, we know our nation literally was ripped apart over the issue of states' rights. And there's all other kinds of protests. You know, I think this is an Antifa riot. I don't remember. But again, they're down on the bottom. You got the civil rights riots that took place in the 1960s. You know, if you have a strong-held belief that you want something, well, there are other people that may say no, and they may push back. And the danger of politics, when it becomes linked with passion, is that oftentimes what could have been achieved through conversations and compromise ends up resulting in violence. Now, we have had our ups and our downs as a society. I'm not going to try to make you go through life with rose-colored lenses. But, in general, we have been blessed that our nation has actually suffered less of this type of political internal conflict than almost every other country on earth. And we do it because the majority of us accepts these core values. And because we accept this, again, our unalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, government based on the consent of the people, those values, this is how, well, really, if you think about it, we've only had one civil war. That was when the nation was most divided. Because at the end of the day, and again, I think our society is an interesting place, because when Biden was president, I kept hearing, oh my God, the nation's so divided, the nation's so divided. But that was not linked to reality. You go to the grocery store, you go to the Home Depot, you go to, you know, the common, you go to the park, and you look around and all you do is see people. Seeing people of all different colors and races and religions. Everyone just kind of like living side by side. And, yeah, sometimes, you know, they'd get a little heated, but, you know, people would talk to one another at a local level. So the notion that we are more divided than ever, it's not true. But you have those people that are on TV that are trying to gin up ratings by manipulating the low-information voters. And that's scary. Because tell me anybody, I don't care how you define yourself, tell me anybody that doesn't want to live, that doesn't want to have rights, and doesn't want to make a good life. And simultaneously, tell me anybody of any political stripe that believes that the government can take them from you. Everyone's going to believe in the rights, and no one's going to say, oh, please, government, take my stuff. That is our saving grace. That is our ultimate defense against tyranny, is that at the end of the day, people can put aside the D's and the R's and say, hey, leave me alone. Now, how does this manifest? Well, political scientists agree that these boil down to four core beliefs. You know, these values synthesize into these four beliefs. Oh, wrong screen. There we go. I got two screens going on, and every now and then I move the mice to the screen where I'm doing the recording versus the screen where the PowerPoint's running. Technology. All right. Personal liberty. Personal liberty has, since the inception of our country, been the most powerful value in our nation from beginning to today. This concept of liberty was one of the primary reasons for declaring independence. I mean, we're all familiar, I hope, with the preamble, the first part of the Declaration. But I'm pretty sure it's in the book, but if not, you can always Google it. Open up the Declaration of Independence if you haven't looked at it recently, and go all the way to the end. In the end, what you see are 27 grievances. Those are the 27 areas where Thomas Jefferson argued that the king's government violated the liberty of the colonists. And by the way, the focus on liberty is also in our state constitution. It's also in our Declaration of Rights, which is the first 32 or 3 articles of our constitution. The very first article begins with the words that echo the Declaration of Independence. And I quote, "All men are born free and equal, and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness." This is what they were focused on. This is why they made the Constitution. Because the purpose of the Constitution is basically to secure us as people, with the blessings of liberty. Those things that the government cannot mess with. The things that make us unique. And by the way, even our patriotic songs talk about this. You know, sweet land of liberty. But what does that mean? What does liberty mean? What does it entail? What does it involve? Well, it's not freedom to do whatever the hell you want, whenever you want. No. But rather, the essence of liberty is the right of self-determination. The right of you determining your fate. Because you're in charge. You set your own goals. You roll up your sleeves and work trying to obtain those goals. No one is going to do it for you. If you want to be poor, you have the right to be poor. Then make stupid decisions. Go out and spend $300 on a pair of sneakers. Go out and spend $1,200 on an iPhone. Go to Starbucks 8 times a day. Spend every last penny you have. You have a right to do that. But you also have a right to become successful. And that's why you're all in school. You're not in college for shits and giggles. No, you're coming to change the way you think, to kind of see the world in a different perspective and obtain some skills that you can basically show a future employer that's going to allow you to make more than those people who don't go to college. So keep that in mind. Liberty isn't just restraint on people, you know, to be free from, but it's also the freedom to do. Also in our society, we have tremendous respect for not only the individual, but individuals in general. Popular rule in our republic stems from the belief that we all have the potential to engage as rational, capable, and fair people. Excuse me. Yes, we have important rights individually, but we also have collective rights. And those are where the government gets its authority from. So again, all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, unalienable rights. In a Republican system, not Republican Party, but in a republic, the republic itself makes everybody, rich or poor, black or white, male or female. That's the central measure of value. So both the state and the union basically are measured as doing good work. You know, is government doing what it's supposed to do? And it's measured against what is happening to the people in society. Now, by the way, again, we take for granted the system in which we live in. And that has made many of us lazy, selfish, narcissistic. But that's not true in all political societies. Socialist states don't value the individual. Rather, they value the mass. Places like the Soviet Union, Cuba, China, even modern France. In those societies, the right of the nation supersedes the rights of the individual. So you can basically be taken by the government and forced to work. You could be taken by the government from your home, and the government can bulldoze it down. You know, ultimately, the government has the ability to do to you whatever it decides. Now, the scary thing is there are some politicians in our country that advocate for this statism, for this socialistic society. And they make it sound nice. But the danger of socialism is that the state is in charge, not you. So the state will tell you where to live. The state will tell you what school you can go to. The state will tell you what job you can pursue. The state will tell you how much money you can make. That's not freedom. That's not freedom. That's totalitarianism. The third concept, equality of opportunity. The importance of the individual is enhanced by the value of the equal opportunity to pursue your goals. As Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created. Oh, wait, this is his first draft. Ooh, do I have that? No, I don't. Don't cheat. From his first draft. Because, man, Jefferson wrote it, and then it was edited. But Jefferson said in his first draft, and I quote, "All men are created equal, and from that equal creation they derive rights, inherent and unalienable, among which are the preservation of liberty and the pursuit of happiness." Little wordy, but basically, these words indicate the primacy of this concept. What does equality actually mean? Equality for who? Equality how? Well, truth be told, equality means you have a chance. That it's not going to say, again, equity. Equity is the latest buzzword that they're pumping down everyone's throat. Equity is when the government determines the outcome and forces similar results. Equality of opportunity means everyone has a chance to line up on the starting line and run the race. Doesn't mean you're going to win, but you have a chance to try. Now, of course, this concept of equality has changed. I'm not going to deny that. We did have a system not too long ago where if you were a slave, if you were an indentured servant, basically, you were not a free man. You were not allowed to own a house. You were not allowed to move to wherever you wanted to go to. You're not allowed to marry who you wanted to marry. Someone else made those decisions for you. If you were a woman, you were not allowed to participate in the electoral process. If you were a Native American, you know, you were forced to live in, you know, reservations. Equality has changed. Equality has morphed. But one of the things that makes our country so beautiful, and by the way, this is where battles and politics are fought for, is that we're at a point now where pretty much you look around in our classroom and you'll see people that look very, very different, but we're all in there doing the same thing. You know, ultimately, you know, that's the equality that our founding fathers envisioned. And yes, it took many generations to get there, but we got there. That's for sure. All right, last but not least, because I'm looking at the time, I'm not going to go over, I hope so. I got 5 minutes left. So let's do this real quick. Popular consent. This is another of the four common beliefs. So you have personal liberty. Society respects you as an individual. Everybody has a chance to pursue their own happiness. And last but not least, governments make their decisions based upon the popular consent. Meaning, the government can only do those things that we, the people, want it to do. That's justice. As is enshrined in the preamble, Declaration of Independence again, that to secure these rights, the governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form, as to them shall seem the most likely to affect their safety and happiness. It's in our founding documents. The government's supposed to do for us what we want it to do. Of course, if there's capacity for it. All right, last click, and this is where we got to talk a little bit about the dark side. We have to recognize, of course, that there are times when the core values are in conflict, when one person's liberty may conflict with the desire for popular consent, or one's sense of equality goes against, you know, what could be perceived to be respectful for another. And again, sometimes this is where political combat occurs. Essentially, this means that certain individuals and certain groups may not get their way. A commitment to popular consent means you must be willing to accept a loss when people essentially vote the other way. So, maybe you voted for Kamala Harris. Well, I hate to break it to you. She lost. Donald Trump is the president. So what does that mean? Well, we have to kind of accept Donald Trump is the president. That means we can hold him accountable. But we also have to hold him to the consent of those people who voted for him as well. You know, there's a way to basically make sure he doesn't go outside the mandate that he was given. What about self-determination? What if you want to do something that conflicts with equal opportunity? You know, you want to get a job and you're basically going to push somebody else aside. One of my favorite hypotheticals to use is, what about the right of a person not to breathe smoke, tobacco smoke, in a restaurant where maybe the owner of the restaurant smokes and he wants to allow smokers into his restaurant? But the government comes in and says, no, you cannot allow smoking, even though you own the business. What about the story we heard about a lot recently in the news? What about the right of the Christian baker not to be forced to make a cake for a homosexual couple? His values did not, he did not want to do it. He wished not to do it. Should the government force him to do that to protect the rights of the gay couple, the homosexual couple? What about the right of a Christian? Oh, I already said that one. What about the right of a blogger? Turtle Boy. And if you know Turtle Boy, man, Turtle Boy is sometimes fierce. He's vicious. He exposes people, but he exposes them based on their own actions. Well, sometimes the people that end up on Turtle Boy become, you know, internet famous, you know, for their 15 minutes of fame. Well, doesn't that person have a right to privacy? Or what about those people who, what do they call it, doxing? So, again, this, we're engaged in this constant political conflict. But ultimately, it's about trying to win. You want to get your opinion, and you want to achieve a victory. And sometimes it happens at the expense of others. But, generally speaking, this combative nature has, for the most part, remained in check. Remember, again, always remember, is that sometimes we've had crazy things happen in our country. We've only had one civil war. So, the thing to remember is that our time are always changing. Our society, our culture is always evolving. And oftentimes, future generations, you know, make decisions for themselves that are different than past generations. Well, one of the beauty things about our country is that's fine. That's the way it's supposed to work. You know, we're not supposed to be locked into the way society was structured. Our government, our Constitution, is not designed to keep us locked in to the way it was back in 1787 when the Constitution was drafted. No, it's allowed us to evolve, and it continually changes again. There was a point when only free citizens could vote, males. Well, they passed the 15th Amendment, which, I'm sorry, the 14th Amendment, which basically prevented the government from denying the right to vote on the basis of, you know, former status of servitude. Then they passed the 19th Amendment, which allowed women to vote, you know. So it's taken time. There's been a lot of arguments. But we always move forward. And that's one of the beautiful things about our country. And by the way, they knew it would happen. As Thomas Jefferson once said, and I quote, "I am increasingly persuaded that the earth belongs exclusively to the living, and that one generation has no more right to bind another to its laws and judgments than one independent nation has the right to command another." So, don't be one of those haters. America is beautiful. I love it. Is it perfect? No. But who is? But I can say this much, and I mean it sincerely. Always remember, we are one of the only countries on earth that people literally die trying to get into. When you look around the world, the vast majority of nations through all history has been the exact opposite. They've had to build walls to keep people in. All right, my friends, I apologize. I went over 2 minutes, but again, I've already given you some time, and I will always try to manage the time over the course of the semester. So if class goes right to the end, you know, I'll give you a few minutes in the following class. So hopefully you enjoyed the whole whopping 1 inch of snow that caused us to cancel school. And hopefully you stay warm, and we'll see you on Wednesday. Peace. Man, I'm looking bad. There we go. There's the mouse. Bye.